I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures. And it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Hey, we need your support more than ever. If you want to get ad-free versions of the show, check the show notes. Click on the link. It takes just a minute, and you will get them for $5 Canadian a month. Or go to canadalandshow.com/join. Thanks a lot. I want you to imagine a list of the worst Canadian TV shows of all time. Now imagine a list of the funniest Canadian TV shows ever. Now think about a list of the most successful Canadian television programs ever made. Well, there's only one show that would make it onto all three of those lists. And that show is Kenny vs. Spenny.
Glory for the winner. Humiliation for the loser. This is Kenny versus Spenny.
In each episode, supposed best friends Kenny Hotz and Spencer Rice were shown to compete in challenges like who can stay awake the longest or who can gain the most weight. The loser would have to endure a frat house humiliation, like eating apples out of a toilet or running through the streets naked. The first season of Kenny vs. Spenny ran on the CBC, with the closing humiliations airing right before the National. Grandparents tuning in a minute early to hear Peter Mansbridge read the news would catch a few moments of Spenny sponge bathing an old man, or Kenny brewing coffee through a pair of used underwear. It was soon canceled. But as the legend goes, Kenny vs. Spenny was then picked up in the U.S., by Showcase and by Comedy Central, where it became a massive international hit.
We have the stars of the hugely successful Canadian TV show Kenny vs. Spenny, which can now be seen in America. Kenny Hotz and Spencer Rice are here. They're national heroes in Canada.
The format of the show was sold to 50 different foreign markets, which produced local versions, such as Ed vs. Spencer in the UK, Juan vs. Roman in Colombia, and Sid versus Varun in India.
Sid versus Varun. Do kamine.
Hi, welcome to Sid versus Varun. Har hafte ki tarah is hafte bhi hum leke aaye hain a unique competition. Who can endure the most torture?
There were a few years there where Kenny versus Spenny was a very big deal. But as the show wore on, the competitions grew more and more disgusting, extreme, and by today's standards, wrong. For every classic Kenny versus Spenny episode, like Who Can Blow the Biggest Fart?
Ah! I'm gonna look like Brad Pitt the second I let this baby go.
Yeah.
Or Who Can Wear a Dead Octopus on Their Head the Longest?
I'm like so sick of wearing this stupid thing and fucking reeks.
There were many others, like Who Can Keep a Dump in Their Pants the Longest?
All right, let's do this, Tom. It's shit time. It's time to shit.
Who do black guys like more?
Spenny has no black friends, none. I've got at least three of them.
Three!
And who can get further with the other guy's mom?
Fucking wasted. Like, I'm seriously drunk, and she's drunk, and I can't bring myself to actually do anything.
Garden variety sexism, like who can bone more women, devolved into who can squeeze more boobs, which was sort of a remarkable episode of television in terms of the sheer number of seemingly real acts of assault it casually depicted.
I'm sorry, girls.
I'm getting some good coughs, man. I'm coughing some good feels, man.
Excuse me, sorry.
Now, all of that might explain why some today might be unfamiliar with Kenny versus Spenny. I mean, the culture has moved so far away from their kind of content so rapidly that it's almost as if Kenny versus Spenny never happened. The show has been called a cult hit, which kind of feels right and explains its obscurity, but it's not really accurate. Kenny vs. Spenny was a mainstream hit, one of the biggest shows this country has ever seen. But the series, and its stars, have kind of disappeared. They released their final season in 2010, and when I was trying to launch Canada Land in 2013, I knew Kenny Hotz had a reputation as a massively successful figure in Canadian TV who was willing to talk massive amounts of shit about the Canadian TV industry to anybody who'd listen. And so he was on the very first list I ever made of guests to chase for this show. But he turned me down flat because, I was told, he just didn't see an upside in publicly shitting on Canadian TV executives. And after all, he was still trying to get his projects made. Well, that was 7 years ago. And in the time since, you know, Kenny has done a show for FX called Testies, which lasted for one season. Another series for the now defunct Action Network here in Canada. It's called Triumph of the Will. That one was 6 episodes. And he's also done some videos for Vice. And that's about it. He owns a bar here in Toronto, and he lives with his wife and their 3 young daughters. He has consistently said that he would do another season of Kenny versus Spenny in a heartbeat if only a broadcaster would greenlight it. And he's pissed about that. And so I asked him again, 7 years later, if he would finally come onto Canada Land, and he said yes. Kenny Hotz spoke to me while under self-isolation from his parked car. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Cassandra Rosen, Chris Laporte, Colin Dacry, Hannah Rabinovich, Kara Zames, Katrina Gower, Maya Sampson, and Paul Jorgensen.
Hi, I'm Paul Jorgensen, and I'm a public servant in Ottawa. I support Canada Land because I find that in English Canada, we are inundated with American media, American news, American pop culture, and I think it's healthy for us to spend a little bit of time each week listening to Jesse and his guests talk about Canadian issues from a Canadian perspective, and I'm proud to support that.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point.
It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand.
Yeah, I'm a Forest Hill Jew, but we were poor. You know, I grew up with billionaires. Where'd you grow up?
I'm a Forest Hill Jew.
Oh, are you? But we went to China House and everyone else went to Chan.
Chan was for birthdays. Chan was for special occasions.
I took my mom to Chan once like 10 years ago and she started crying.
Oh.
It's too expensive. What do you think? And of course, it was terrible.
It didn't make sense to me that you were from Forest Hill because you don't seem like a Forest Hill Jewish kid, but Spenny seems a bit more like that.
Spenny's Rosedale. He went to UCC.
Oh, Jesus.
And like Thornton Hall or something. Yeah, it's pathetic. First of all, I love you just because of Gomeshi. We hated Gomeshi so fucking much. He was the creepiest. Every girlfriend I ever had, the second they met him, said, keep him away from me. But yeah, I'm a big fan, by the way. I have a hard time with Canadian journalism. I like to see myself as the antithesis of Canadian content. I'm more of a global genius.
What's wrong with Canadian content?
Listen, I grew up on the NFB, so one of the greatest film boards in the world. And you know, there's certain Canadian stuff I love, but I think historically it was very Christian based and highly moral, and you know, my family's sat around a table our whole lives that we never mentioned Saskatoon. And I find grant systems kind of a form of censorship in a sense, because somebody has to judge whether you're appropriate for funding. Listen, what's wrong with Canadian funding? I'm not sure if you've ever seen The Trouble with Tracy or Party Game. There's been some duds, but there's duds everywhere, you know. SCTV to me is the greatest show in the history of television, second only to my own, you know. And being Jewish too, like, you know, they used to call us wine and shyster at the CBC because we were like the first Jews on TV for like 30 years.
Kenny, I'm so happy to be talking to you. I had heard that you were willing to talk shit about the Canadian content system 7 years ago, and you wouldn't talk to me about this. People said, you got to talk to Kenny. If you want to bitch about this, this is the guy to talk to. And it took us 7 years.
Well, I don't really want to beat that drum and bitch on the system because I milked the shitload out of it. But, you know, I do content for the global village. I think, you know, people are the same everywhere. When we did Kenny versus Spenny, I would systematically cut out Canadian dollars or anything that had to do with Canada because I wanted just to seem like a generic city anywhere in the world, like Seattle or Chicago or something. Of course, it was 100% Canadian, but we are such Hollywood star fuckers that, you know, we wanted to kind of be part of that system. But I, you know, I lived in LA for 10, 11, 12 years. I came back, you know, I prefer being here.
You have this whole pre-Kenny versus Spenny media existence. You were a war zone photojournalist?
Well, I was, for my bar mitzvah, I bought a Canon AE-1 and started taking photos. My brother was like the greatest artist in the world. His life drawings got him into med school and he was a shitty student. But because he was such an incredible artist, I was always so pissed off that I couldn't draw that I figured off, you know, I got into photography and movies. You know, our parents sent us to film school, NFB film school at the Harborfront Ice House when I was like 6 years old, where I directed my first film, which was a cartoon. But, you know, we were rabid TV watchers and I grew up with all Canadian content and I'm a huge fan of Canadian content. I'm not a huge fan of shit content. I just love great stuff. And I wish I probably if I was shittier, I'd be better. You know, I'd probably have more cash and more fame. But, you know, I kind of feel like I'm Canada's Sid Barrett. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just an egomaniacal narcissist.
It sounds like kind of a love-hate thing. If you were like, learned how to make films from the NFB and you think SCTV is the best show ever made, and then CBC gave you your big break, how could you hate Canadian content? Canadian content sort of made you. It was very good to you.
You know, take Tom Green, for example. To me, Tom Green, who is one of my closest friends, was revolutionary, a Kaufman-esque fucking, you know, his stuff was so incredible and funny. And CBC offered him a pilot and didn't pick him up. And, you know, a week later, the guy's on the cover of Rolling Stone. And we were kind of the next guys in line that had a pilot from L.A. And I think the CBC went, oh, shit, we fucked that up. And then they, you know, thanks to John Moranis and Peter Sussman, who we grew up with, bamboozled us a series. And you know, we didn't fuck it up, thank God. But, you know, it became like a catch-22 where it was during the genre of Tom Green and especially Jackass, where things were so crass and rude and we were kind of a spin-off of that kind of crass, rude humor, which I'm kind of embarrassed about. But, you know, how do you compete with South Park and Family Guy and Jackass when these guys are sitting in outhouses going upside down, covering themselves in shit? Like, it was a genre piece, and the humiliation at the end of our show was really just a Tom Green Jackass vignette that we added to the end of the show to kind of emulate their brand, in a sense. It was organic and it worked. I didn't feel like we actually stole anything. In fact, those guys were actually watching the show, Knoxville and Spike Jones. And Matt and Trey were watching it as well, just because, you know, we were pretty honest and original and part of the zeitgeist, which was nice because we deserve it. I lived in LA in a garage for fucking 6 years without a car. Like, it sucked. We were destitute and broke. We definitely deserve this, you know, C-level celebrity cult fame we have. But again, you know, you could say that there was a vacuum in Canadian content at the time, as I find there is now for comedy a little bit, though people would disagree. Oh, great. Here comes my kids to ride their bikes. And it was because of that vacuum and because we were the antithesis of morality that the show popped, because our audience was so fed up with fucking Littlest Hobo and these other shows. When I Spenny wore makeup and I didn't, because I wanted to be like Dogma. I thought when people are changing channels and they see this like panda with AIDS, you know, they're like, holy shit, what is this? And it just, you know, for me, that was just real. And I wanted to be as real and as honest as possible.
Yeah. I think Tina Fey said something about how comedy likes banged up faces. Like, it's not good if everybody looks too slick.
I think after a big part of it, too, was after 9/11, people were just so sick of fucking bullshit. You know, after watching OJ in that car and that fucking building collapse, they just couldn't deal with this fucking hokey network bullshit. It was just kind of real.
It's,
well, you could probably explain it better than I can. I was kind of trapped in it, but I loved it. To me, it's the funniest TV show ever. You know, I was just watching an episode the other day and howling. I'm kind of proud of it, though. Matt and Trey said that it was highly moralistic and we never exploited anybody. Like, you know, if I had some Down syndrome kid say Spenny molested him, I didn't call the kid a retard. We became best friends. We were self-deprecating. And when we do Who Do Gay Guys Like More, we both try to have sex with a gay guy, which embarrassed, you know, some of our jock, shitty, homophobic audience. We do Who Could Drink More Beer, and we didn't glorify beer. We made Spenny looked like a disgusting alcoholic, and we do Who Can Smoke More Weed, and it's fucking gross, you know. And Jackass and Tom Green kind of loved what they did, whereas we victimized ourselves. and we hated what we did, which made it kind of real. The reality is the audience is the sick ones. It's the gladiator ring. They're the fucking scumbags who we had to diddle. They're the cruel ones. I had to destroy my best friend's life and relationship for their joy, even though it was probably his fetish. It was still very unique to me. It's a special show, and people fucking, it's got a 500 million views on fucking YouTube, and I still like walk down the street, and you know, I remember seeing Don Candy at Lawrence Plaza, and we got on the ground and bowed to him, and kids, 10-year-old kids come up and do that to me now, which is, I fucking love it. So I love the fame. Spenny hates it. Like I am so happy. I can't tell you. I love it.
You're working out a lot of stuff, Kenny. I don't even know where to begin. I feel like I should give you some kind of context or ground rules for this conversation. First of all, I think the show is very funny. In a sense, it was very much a document of this moment where along with Jackass and Tom Green, I don't know what you want to call it, no brow, gross out, or people call it, you know, fratty jock humor, or just like the comedy of disgust. But at the same time, it was like a classic Catskills comedy duo. You're the maniac and he's the neurotic. It goes back to like the essential units of comedy in a lot of ways. Like, I don't know. I could look at it a lot of different ways. It's the best. It's the funniest show ever. I'm not even going to touch that. You didn't exploit anyone. I just watched an episode where you had like a guy with, I guess, dwarfism, a little person who was dressed in a diaper.
And that wasn't saying, me.
Wah, baby's thirsty here. Can I have a bottle? Where's my bottle?
Spenny, I nodded my head and I said, this is disgusting and you should not do this. This is bad for you.
You gotta stop. You gotta
keep
stop.
Going, keep going.
Yeah, you gotta stop doing this. Honestly, this is not right. He's totally exploiting you.
And Spenny should apologize. Spenny is the scumbag. Spenny's the twisted, angry, neurotic villain in this. I would never do that to anybody. And like, you watch that and what did I do? I said, dude, put your clothes on. He's exploiting you. This is not good. Like, stop this right now.
I'm not going to do it. I'm not falling for it. You want me to put you on trial? Like, you have to take responsibility, of course, for a depiction on your TV show. You can't make that Spenny's fault. Like, that was on your show.
I wanted to show you that so that you would know what a disgusting, depraved fucking scumbag he is. That's why that was in there. Because the important thing was for me to make him look bad. And for me to look great, because I am a little narcissistic, but that was fun. You know, the duality, all I wanted to do was just get the audience to laugh and like me. And because they're so sick, conflict is comedy. So the worse he looked, the funnier it was and the better I looked.
I don't even want to. It's not even interesting. This is blaming the audience now. And then this idea, like what I like about the show is you could say anything you want about the show, but it's honest about what it is. But that was one moment of dishonesty because you definitely used for laughs that this guy was in a diaper saying, I'm a baby. But then you say, oh, Spenny, you're exploiting this guy. And that's supposed to let you off the hook. I didn't like that one moment, but it doesn't matter. Like,
I didn't know he was going to do that. I had no idea that I've never even met that guy. I sat there and he surprised him with me. So this wasn't pre-written or anything. It was like filming Spenny was like a nature documentary. Neither of us really knew what each other were doing.
Yeah, I don't want to do that either. Like, I think that there's a you've done 1,000 interviews, and one of that is, oh, was that real or not? It's clear to me that the show uses elements of reality, but is a constructed piece of comedy that has kind of a traditional three-act structure to how the whole thing goes. The episodes all have like a format, which you sold around the world to 50 different, which is just, that's just staggering to me. And then are we going to hold you responsible for your crimes against humanity in the year 2020? Like, it's not great that the show has you're gay as this, like, you know, you're a retard as the joke, you know, every 5 seconds. It's also a product of its time. And I'm not here to moralize you.
Yeah, I'm not happy. There's certain things I'm not happy about, but you know, The Beatles Get Back is, you know, I read is about immigrants going back, leaving England. So who fucking knows what context is? But the fact is I'm a good, loving person. And, you know, I'm happy. I like myself.
A lot.
Yeah. Less and less every day, but still a lot.
Look, like I say, I enjoy the show and I think it's a really interesting thing to look at, which is why I want to talk. I mean, I was...
watching a lot of old interviews with you, and it's interesting how you're saying that you feel like the show was really about something. You said it exposed moral truths about shitty humanity, and it exposed the male ego. And that, I was thinking about, I'm like, well, was this show like an expose or a satire of the male ego, or was it reveling in the male ego and the competitiveness between male friends and pubescent or prepubescent comedy of disgust stuff? Like it's a celebration of that stuff more than it's like a rejection of that stuff.
I think maybe that was just a natural dynamic of our character, you know, maybe it's just...
Mm-hmm.
You know what Abbott and Costello or Laurel and Hardy were like together. I don't know. And, you know, you click into character. I never competed. Spenny and I never really competed before this, or, you know, I'm not a competitor. I hate fucking sports. I really hate sports. Like, I hate the competitive nature of society. I think in sports, we should like come together and build like a tower, like the Spanish, and put a little kid on top of it and try to accomplish these Herculean tasks, as opposed to try and get some stupid fucking piece of plastic in a hole.
So you thought I was going to be mean to you in this interview, but I see you in interviews protesting that the show is actually complex and has a lot to say. So it sounds like you want to be taken seriously. I'm going to take you very seriously. Here's my most pretentious analysis of Kenny versus Spenny. So there's only two kinds of comedy, is this philosophy that I'm getting wrong, but I think this is basically it. There's the white clown and the red clown. And the white clown takes himself really seriously and wants to have a lot of pride and dignity, but is a ludicrous figure. And essentially it's because he can try to have dignity as much as he wants, but he's a clown. And it all kind of ultimately, it's like he's wearing a death mask, and it's sort of an existential humor.
Like a mime, yeah.
And the red clown is goofy and garish and in your face and is farting and shitting, and the comedy is just about falling down. And that's the only other kind of humor, is just the most basic corporeal bodily functions.
Funny thing is, I turned Spenny into both of those clowns and tried to stay out of looking like a clown.
Well, you are a clown. You're the red clown, aren't you? Aren't you like shameless? You know, the white clown is full with shame. That's Spenny. And the red clown is just an absolute goof, doesn't give a shit. And there's such joy in watching a screwball, maniac, rascal character who just does not have any of the hangups we have. And is like, you know, whatever, you can put it any way you want. You're the id, he's the ego, right? It's the basics.
I don't really want to be seen as a clown, though. Like, I thought I was, like, you know, kind of better than that. Like, I didn't want to kind of be embarrassed, so.
You don't see yourself, like, you shit your pants on the show and walked around.
I'm really embarrassed about that. Like that was the one show that I really, we kind of got caught up in that. And so that was just cringy to me. I can't even watch that show. Like, to me, that show was just so terrible and embarrassing now. Like, that's a show I'd be embarrassed if my kids watch. So we made mistakes. Look, I'm a fucking idiot. I can't be perfect all the time, but I think all in all, and another reason is, I think, you know, the fact that we're so successful is because we're so crass, but that's the reason why we're not on Netflix now, is because part of the reason why executives don't understand how popular and how much we mean to the millennials or our demographic, because they can't, there's a separation between our kind of popularity and our content and them just seeing us as jackass, when it wasn't that at all. It was, to me, it was complex, and it did have there was a kind of message in it.
I don't have the authority to absolve you for your sins, and I'm not really comfortable judging you for them either. It is what it is. You made the show, and I do think that the real thrust of the humor was self-abuse and abuse of each other. I think that can be said pretty...
Yeah, it was very self-deprecating, you know what I mean? But I've made a lot of content, and my stuff is not just self-deprecating, but does, you know, poke fun at the, you know, man's inhumanity to man and just how shitty we are as a species. And you know, I'm kind of a dick, and I like people getting their fucking just desserts. Like, I love me too. I think these scumbags deserve to get fucking crushed if they're assholes, you know?
To look at it like that moment of Tom Green and Jackass and Kenny versus Spenny, this kind of genre of guys flipping themselves overboard in outhouses or shit, like actually comedy with shit and the bodies of dead animals and sexual, like all of this sort of like self-degradation dares and the kind of hazing-ish kind of stuff.
I notice it was all white guys. It seemed like it was only white guys too. What do you think about that? Do you have any thoughts on why it was?
Well, first of all, I had one black guy, Mike Latchford, in my grade, in grade eight, and he was my best friend. There's hardly any black people here. You know, when you go to Atlanta or Chicago, you're like, oh my God, this is America. So, it's just the population demographic. But I didn't really care. We did who can make out with more chicks. One of the girls was black, or I had Thor carry me up and down the stairs. It's just Canada. You know, I was probably one of the only few people in my group who had black friends or, you know, Chinese friends or whatever. My dad used to say my bedroom looked like the cafeteria at the UN. And that's true. That's a real fucking joke that my dad told me, because, you know, my girlfriends were so multicultural, you know. But that's what happens when you go to public school in Toronto and you're a foodie and you want to eat fucking Tibetan mutton and duck, you know, Chinese duck, or, you know, whatever other cultures we were lucky enough to interact with. And, you know, people, when Forest Hill went Chinese, a lot of people there said, oh, he's fucking, wait, it's all Chinese. I was like, whatever makes more, you know, Chinese restaurants, that's all I care about in the fucking city. Like, they were growing up at Bathurst and Eglinton. You think there were no black people? Like, I wish there were, but, you know, that's what happens. Fuck, go to Victoria. You know, it's like, shit's crazy here. It's really different. And then living in the U.S., I was so happy that I was like, oh, great. Now, you know, I can be friends with you know, different people that I haven't had, you know, on the West Coast of America that I haven't really had the ability to interact with. You know, it's impossible to get a patty or a roti out there in L.A., but, you know, all of a sudden I had, like, insanely amazing, you know, Somali or Ethiopian or you know, Bangladeshi or, you know, Albanian food, stuff that we didn't really have here, or Russian stuff, you know. I that wasn't intentional or anything. That's just Toronto. Now things are different. Immigrants actually, Toronto was growing up, it was a shitty place where a lot of people were assholes. And the influx of immigration actually made everyone nicer and made it cooler. And so I'm cool with that. But it was a bunch of, you know, white guys who were dicks mostly, you know.
You made a series of choices as to how to interpret that question, as the responses will be yours to live with.
I'm not a racist, so
let me try that a different way.
Yeah,
I can see things a couple different ways. Like, I can see what you did and what Tom Green did and what you know, Jackass, and like, I can kind of almost see it in a lineage that starts with like Monty Python. These were like British guys who were sent to like the finest schools, and they were kind of handed the crown of like, this is what a dignified patriarchal, like a British gentleman is your birthright, and what ripe material for comedy, right? If somebody does you the favor of giving you that role, then you just, you know, dress up in a dress or shit your pants or make fun of that dignified character. And so the relationship between whiteness and that kind of gross out humor might be just that like, Why were all these kind of like punk rockish kind of suburban or middle class white kids the ones to like hump dead moose and shit their pants? Because maybe that's just funnier, and maybe that's just like a funnier joke if it's a white guy doing it. That's one way I could think of it.
You know, I was just, to me, Kenny versus Benny is just trying to make my brother and my friends laugh. You know what I mean? Because I knew they were watching it. So, and the crew, I surrounded myself with friends in the crew. And they were such cynical dicks that it was so hard to make them laugh. But I was really just performing for them in a sense. And that hopefully, you know, migrated through the camera a bit.
That's sort of a highlight of the show, is the crew. And there's a weird tension there where you can't tell if they're like kind of on the team and having fun with you, or if they're like, fuck, my job, I have to like smell this guy's.
Yeah.
That this is like a workplace issue. That doesn't look faked at all.
It looked
like
no,
the crew is actually just.
You know, Tim Conway laughed on Carol Burnett, so or people laugh on SNL. I'm glad it was just natural and honest. So, and I think people were fed up with just the bullshit of you know, and going back to Canadians like Agoyan or Cronenberg or these guys, it was so I don't know. I just found the Canadian films were just so, like, obnoxious and moralistic and pretentious. It was like, oh, crazy, because I was a filmo, you know? It's like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm watching every incredible filmmaker all over the world, and the Canadian government's giving $20 million for Passion Fail. You know, it's like, oh, it's so annoying. You know what I mean? And they just didn't have this kind of natural global sensitivity. It was Canadian for the sake of being Canadian, and that made me crazy, because I'd go to TIFF every year, and I'd literally sit in the fucking theater for five, six films a day, and when I did see something Canadian, it just stunk of pretentious self-fucking gratification. It was just so cheesy and hokey, and some stuff, you know, I can mention 30 Canadian fucking films that I loved. I don't think Canadians can even mention 3. There could be incredible content out here. And unfortunately, historically, some people handing out the cash have been a little more, you know, concerned about, you know, whether it makes it into Cannes as opposed to whether it makes it onto, you know, people's computers. You know, this a country that has made very few Canadian comedies. You know, we got canceled on CBC. We were the number one show. People just didn't appreciate our humor and our, you know, je ne sais quoi. And then we get to America and they got it instantly. It was like, oh, fuck, it's so refreshing. It worked and we got lucky. And I'm not mad or about anything. I think I'm so fucking lucky. It's crazy. I never won a fucking Gemini. We're on Comedy Central. They're giving Geminis to the guys who wrote The Buzz, and we never got shit. Like, it was really depressing. Like, for some reason, people just ignored us, and it sucked, you know. And it's tough to, you know, have a half billion views and to be one of the most famous Canadian comedies in the history of the country, and for people not to give you respect. I demand respect.
You wore a dead octopus on your head. You shit your own pants.
Yeah, and they still never know. They still didn't notice. And you know what? And Diplo and Kardashian, and there's like, we got fans who are like, Octopus was one of the greatest Canadian episodes in the history of Canadian television. We were the diplomats of Canadian content. When you went anywhere in the world, people thought, oh, Canadians are such losers and they're always so polite. We showed the world that we're like some of the worst people on earth and extremely funny. And I walk down the street in Hamburg and we get chased, you know. And listen, I love everything. I'm totally happy, but you know, a Gemini would have been nice, you know, seriously. Like, we're literally like, guys in fucking Nairobi are watching our show. U.S. forces are watching our shit in tanks driving into Afghanistan. Like, you know, some recognition for our accomplishments spreading Canadian content globally would be nice. Yeah, aside from the cash and fame and super hot, gorgeous wife and beautiful kids and lots of money.
Kenny, I would think that the actual reward would not, like, who gives a shit about a Gemini? I would think that after you had a success on the scale that you had, and this is something that I felt was true of the Kids in the Hall as well, and others, the prize you'd think would be a career.
It is, but you know, I'm a bit of a suck ass, and I would like some recognition would be nice. And yes, I did get some, but we're on Comedy Central. On fucking Comedy Central. And there's no recognition for it. Like, who the fuck is on Comedy Central? What Canadian shows are on US networks and cable networks? Not that I honestly don't care and I'm not mad about it, but you know, I see other shows over the years that have a facade of being popular, and they're getting tons of kudos and accomplishments. I just think they could have tossed us a bone here and then and said, you know, thank you.
Sure. But what I'm more interested in is this thing that I've been talking about with lots of people on the show, and not just comedians. Like, I've talked about this with members of the Kids in the Hall. I've talked about this with Stephen Page of the Bare Naked Ladies. It feels like there's almost limits to Canadian fame. Like, there's no second acts in Canadian public life. You can't reinvent yourself in some David Bowie or even like Will Ferrell. Will Ferrell did like
comedy that a lot of people considered pretty juvenile. And now he's like executive producer of Secession, you know, like a premium HBO show.
I would, because I'm an artist and a filmmaker, I think I would have stayed and made incredible content and high budget features and different genres. So, which is one of the reasons why it's kind of upsetting that I never really got that shot in a sense. I never really fought for it because I'm too cool for cash. I don't really care about making money or really working too hard. So I don't, it's kind of a scummy for me to say, hey, give me awards so I can direct big movies in LA. But like, you know, we were crass and people mistook us for being kind of disgusting as opposed to being a narrative sitcom about two friends. And it's really a show about love in a sense, as opposed to Jackass or those guys. So, but again, look, even Jackass made gabillions and Knoxville had respect, which is fine. I don't want to talk about that because I feel respected anyhow. And I feel like I accomplished unbelievable dreamlike goals. So I'm fine. But, you know, it'd be nice to go to Trudeau's house or, you know, hang out with, you know, Neil. When you're living with Matt and Trey and they're telling you you're a genius and one of the funniest people on earth, the fact nobody else notices it does get a little annoying. But again, I don't want to harp on it or even say I care about it. And I'm still, you know, right now I'll give you an exclusive that there is some serious talk about the series coming back. I've never said that to anybody. I will say that to you. And I'm currently working on the possibility of the show returning. More of a chance of it happening now than ever before. It'll probably happen.
Well, I know that you don't like to talk out of hand speculatively about stuff that's in development that's never going to happen. So if you're sharing that there's a good chance there's going to be another season, thanks for the exclusive. My guess is that you're probably going to do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, things fall through, you know, we're probably all going to die.
There is that.
Shit like this interrupts it, but it's good that things are getting shaken up.
I feel like coronavirus presents possibilities for Kenny versus Spenny episodes.
Well, I don't really like doing stuff, you know, in Kenny versus Spenny that's time-based or anything. Like my journalistic news stuff that I go out where I'm kind of a gonzo journalist, like the millennials, Geraldo or Anderson Cooper. I did that Trump thing with Spike Jonze and Viceland, and I did a couple with them. And to me, that's really my joy is going out and doing like hard-hitting gonzo journalism.
We didn't get to that. Before we go, talk to me about your interest in journalism. Because we mentioned that you used to be a photojournalist, but you didn't really talk about it. And then more recently, you've been doing these live hits where for Vice, you were going out and interviewing people and you're doing other stuff like that. Like, what is your interest in news journalism?
Well, I just like being dropped somewhere and having to create gold out of nothing. So to me, it's the hardest thing in the world to do documentary because you're just planted somewhere and you have to create something funny, you know, so you're just going out in a place, you're trying to find out what the true story is. And I think to me, there's a vacuum that there's nobody to represent the millennials and people are shitting on these kids going out and being in parks and not giving their distance and stuff, but it's because they don't trust the media. And why don't they trust the media? That's not their fault. That's their product of their environment. It's the media's fault. So I think I have the possibility of becoming one of the only trusted news sources for my demographic because they trust me and they believe me and I'll kill myself to tell them the truth. I think I should be on CNN or Al Jazeera or, you know, I think I'd make an incredible comedy journalist. I think there's a vacuum now in comedy journalism. I think there's a vacuum in news. I think I'm a piece of a puzzle that should probably be out there. Not that I'm going to fight to do it because it's a lot of fucking work and I'm 53 and I'm getting old, but which is part of the pathetic, you know, the fact that I'm old and that I don't really care that much or the fact that I'm self-gratifying and I'd like to spend my money in a James Beard restaurant instead of going out there and finding the news is funny as well because I'm so kind of shitty. Like I said, yeah, I did a show called Triumph for the Will. Did you see Take My Mom, Please? Or
I did.
My old widowed Jewish mother has been alone for decades. My challenge is to find her love.
That was surprisingly, it was very sweet. It was sweet.
But no one's ever done a show about a son's love for his mother. This is real stuff. Like, you know, real story that exists everywhere in everybody's fucking living room. You know, you could walk up to somebody on the street and I could get an incredible fucking story out of them because everybody's got one. So that's kind of like a joyous detective type of fun thing I have, is kind of getting that out of nothing, the ethereal nothingness of life, and finding these very intricate and incredible kind of stories and showing a basic human truth and trying to be funny. But whatever, right now I'm fucking cleaning diapers and making KD. So the juxtaposition of my life being like a cult celebrity and selling out shows and like Thunder Bay and then coming back and just scraping fucking dried noodles out of my couch is, it's so crazy, my life.
So to summarize, millennials can't be held responsible for ignoring the self-isolation rules and congregating. It's actually the media's fault, but that could be fixed if you were on CNN because they'd listen to you, but you're not going to bother because it's too much work. But that would actually make the content even better, the fact that you don't care.
But no, I think if it wasn't so corporate and everybody didn't talk the same and the people responsible for putting people on air were cooler, then yeah, of course we'd have more news. But because massive corporations run multi-organizations, and there's a certain stereotypical type of journalism that look at you, look at you, got Gomeshi. I'm sure everybody's saying, just shut up. Don't, like, fuck it. We do not need this. Like, how many people came up to you and said, do not, like, just let this go? Because you were, you know, infiltrating a really old prehistoric culture, especially in this country. And I'm sure people hated you for doing that. We loved you. And we were so happy that someone was shitty enough to do that. And finally, you know, that's real journalism to me. That's really popping a story. And I don't think people go out there and hoof it anymore like they did in old, like, Cary Grant movies where they would have press in their hand. Oh, we got to go find the story. Let's go get the story. Nobody actually goes out there and gets their own stories. That's what I like to do because, you know, I grew up on those movies. So I want to be that gumshoe journalist that goes and finds the most important story in the world. You know, I want a fucking Pulitzer because I demand respect because I've been working so hard trying to teach these kids how to fucking, you know, be good people and not do shit for money or destroy the fucking planet. And I think we'd all be better off for it. But, you know, you can watch my call. You can watch my stuff and make a decision for yourself. You know, I have no mandate. I have no corporate agenda. I'm, you know, not that smart. You know, I never really finished university. I don't really read, so I'm kind of like a genius idiot, but still maintain likability, which is incredible.
Kenny Hotz, you're a complicated guy, and I'm grateful for the nice things you said about me, and I'm grateful that you took all this time to talk with me. Thank you.
Yes, I lied. Well, I'm going to take you out. If my bar ever opens again, if I don't have to torch it, then I'll take you out. But we should be. I'm surprised we weren't pals, and I should have called you because I did have some really good, like, insane news stories for you. And I'll be your CI, your secret CI. I'll give you some real good stuff to write about.
That is your Canada Land episode. If you liked it, join our supporters. Get ad-free versions of this. It's a good thing to do. Just click the link in your show notes. It's pretty easy. You can email me at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read what you send me. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadalandshow.com. Listen, there are big political decisions being made in this country right now about the way that we are going to transform this country in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. And you need to stay on top of that. And we have a podcast called Oppo that is going to help you do that. They've got a new episode out this week. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Kasia Mihailovic is our senior producer. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures. And it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get
for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.